From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As much as we long for it, hope for it, we're not holding our breath waiting for a cure for cancer. But more understanding means better treatment, and better treatment means longer life. On Sunday, a big step in the understanding of breast cancer, the publication of the first comprehensive genetic map. It's not one thing, breast cancer. It's several things, and now we see them all. This hour On Point, mapping, treating, and maybe one day curing breast cancer. You can join the conversation. Is this information, this insight, urgent for you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a moment, we'll talk with the lead author of the new genetic study and with one of the nation's top breast oncologists. And later in this hour, we'll hear more about the new Korean study that tracked centuries of long-lived eunuchs to explore the effect of testosterone on male lifespans. But first, for an overview of the new breast cancer study, Victoria Colliver, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, joins us. Victoria, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
So first, the project. This is part of a great big federal project called the Cancer Genome Atlas. They've already looked at a number of cancers and now breast cancer. In broad stroke, what do they find in the genetic profile, Victoria?
This is pretty exciting stuff. One of the researchers spoke with said that it gave him chills. Basically, what they're doing is they're mapping, they're looking at 20 different cancer types. This is the fifth study to come out of this huge federally funded project that you mm-hmm. mentioned, the Cancer Genome Atlas. And this breast cancer study, really, there was two main findings. First off, they looked at classifying breast cancer types according, you know, to treatment types. And they found that actually we haven't quite been doing that in the most effective way. And they reclassified it into four distinct genetic types.
Does that means there are four distinct kinds of breast cancer coming from
many different types, but mm-hmm. they're looking at it in terms of, you know, for treatment types. We had been looking at, you know, what targets and what targets it didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So this one basically reclassified it into four genetic types.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part of it, which is possibly the most exciting part, is that they actually found that one of the types of breast cancers had more in common with the type of ovarian cancer that was part of a previous study than it did with the other types of breast cancers. And that means, the interesting part of that is it means that it opens up different treatment options in the sense that we've long been looking at cancers in different silos, like breast cancer, lung cancer, really site of origin. And this is saying, hey, maybe that's not the right way to do it. We should look at the genetic types, and maybe one cancer has more in common with a different cancer of origin in a different part of the body than it does with the cancers that it has in the same point of origin, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. So classifying it by where it shows up may not be mm-hmm. the point here. There may be commonalities across regions where
cancers
show up. Exactly,
when you look at the genetics. You know, we had looked at the researchers explained to me that they kind of divided breast cancer into three types, whether it's hormone receptor positive, estrogen, or progesterone. We have things to target that. Whether it expresses largest amounts of this molecule called HER2, and there's a drug called, the first one called Herceptin, mm-hmm. and there's been other drugs since that target that. And then there's a third type that basically they called for triple negative. It didn't have the receptors, and it was a difficult diagnosis because it didn't have those targets, and it actually was kind of unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
This one kind of shuffled it a little bit and divided it into four different types, and there's some overlap. But the basal type, which is used to be, it includes most, but not all, of the triple negatives.
Mm-hmm.
That's a type that has actually more in common with ovarian cancers, and it's been really a tough one because it's so aggressive. I think it's about 15-20% women have that type of breast cancer. It opens up a whole bunch of different treatment options, hopefully.
Victoria, we'll ask the lead author himself and an oncologist in a moment, but when you've got a genetic roadmap, how big a step is that toward figuring out why cancer happens, breast cancer happens in this case, and looking at that, you know, ever elusive cure?
Well, in this case, it identified about 40 new different targets, or 40 different targets in general. And basically, it gives the people trying to cure cancer and find treatments something to aim at. And I think that there's been a lack of that. We've known some targets, but we haven't known that all that many. And this lays it out and gives them something to go after.
Victoria Colliver with the San Francisco Chronicle. I appreciate you being with us for a few minutes today. Thanks so much for joining us. The study published Sunday in the journal Nature was the latest from the Cancer Genome Atlas, a big federal project that's already done mapping on brain cancer, ovarian cancer, colon cancer, and lung cancers. The lead author of the breast cancer study is Dr. Charles Perreault, professor of genetics at the Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of North Carolina. He joins us now. Dr. Perreault, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks so much for joining us. And with me in the studio, Dr. Judy Garber, breast oncologist and director of the Center for Cancer Genetics and Prevention at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. She's professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Garber, welcome to you as well. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. Congratulations, Chuck.
Yes. Chuck Perreault, Dr. Perreault, congratulations on coming out with this. We're going to dive in, but give us your big headline. What do you see as most important in the big map that you've now laid out before us?
Well, Victoria hit two of the nails on the head there. And, you know, just to reiterate, I think the first major finding is that it very much confirms and extends some of our past findings that breast cancer is not one disease, but it's at least four different diseases. I think the main advancement is that now we have, I think, a very good look at what are some of the likely genetic causes of these four different diseases.
When you say genetic causes, does it mean mutation in every case, or is it something that a woman is born with, or both?
This particular study was mostly focused on the mutations, the acquired mutations that certainly give rise to many of these tumors.
So this would be usually a woman who's living along and something goes on in her genes. Why?
We still don't know quite why. It could be potential, what we'll call some life history features. We know that there's some known risk factors for breast cancer.
Exposure to chemicals or you name it?
Possibly exposure to chemicals or other, you know, life history features. And then sometimes just plain bad luck. You know, you get many of these acquired mutations, and actually it takes multiple hits, 2, 3, maybe 4 different mutations probably before you get a full-blown breast cancer.
Judy, looking at this new study, and it's big, and here's the whole thing laid out. You spend your life looking at cancer genetics and cancer treatment. I mean, is this a new, world of information for doctors to go to work on? How big a deal is it for you to see have the whole thing laid out genetically?
Well, I would agree with Chuck. I think that this provides some real roadmap, if you will, ways to try to think about why these tumors are not all the same. Why don't they respond to the same treatments in the same way, even when they're in the same subsets? And what can we do to be smarter about how we treat women so we don't waste their time with treatments that won't work and can try to use treatments that are more likely to work?
So, Dr. Perreault, I'm a novice here. We're talking about four different kinds of breast cancer, but then I heard Victoria talk about 40. I mean, how many variations are there here? Or is it one of these Rubik's Cubes of endless variation?
It really is endless variation. So every patient is unique, and no two patients are the same. However, with that said, we can put them into these four larger bins, and each of these is defined by some common biologic features. And what we saw in this study was that each of these bins was associated with mutations in certain genes, and other of the tumor types might not have these mutations. So that really suggested to us that if you had this mutation, you almost always had one of the four diseases, and therefore, you know, I'm going to say that mutation is really causing that disease. And it also suggests that if we really want to make a therapeutic impact in that particular disease, we need to target that mutation or the pathway that it's part of, because it must be critical for that patient and for that disease type.
Dr. Garber, to my understanding, it's been a while since there was one treatment for breast cancer. I mean, already they're looking very closely at what type people have before you go in with therapy, with treatment. Does this outline the prospect of even more tailored, more personalized cancer therapy treatment?
Absolutely, Tom. I think that's the whole hope. We did get smarter somewhere along the way and recognized that some tumors were driven by hormones more. What is called in Chuck's paper the luminal tumors mm-hmm. were more hormones sensitive and hormone driven. So the therapies blocked hormones or inhibited them in other ways. The HER2 positive tumors, at least most of them, responded to treatment with molecules targeting HER2. Not all of them, but those molecules, those drugs like Herceptin, mm-hmm. did not work in tumors that did not show that. So at least it allowed us to distinguish. But what this helps you, I hope, to strategize about is, you know, not all tumors that looked like they were the same because they had one alteration like an estrogen receptor abnormality mm-hmm. responded the same way. And this gives you a glimpse into why that's true and maybe a way to figure out in advance which ones need more.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the first comprehensive genetic analysis of breast cancer, our new understanding of breast cancer and treatment. Just out Sunday, the lead author is Dr. Charles Perreault at the University of North Carolina. He joins us today from Chapel Hill. Also with us in this hour is Dr. Judy Garber from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, right in the middle of all this as a breast oncologist. Dr. Perreault in Chapel Hill. So here's my question. Now you've got the genetics laid out. When a person, likely a woman, goes in and breast cancer is discovered, are all medical facilities in this country, are most of them equipped to figure out which of these four big bins her cancer is in, doctor, or not?
No, they're not. There's still some, you know, development of these findings into what I'll call the next generation of clinical diagnostics is certainly going to be the implication of this. You know, these four bins are roughly encompassed by the existing three biomarkers that are used for breast cancer, the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2. So
right.
The women are getting put into
close.
Some
mm-hmm.
close mm-hmm. and some certainly therapeutically highly relevant bins. So we're just going to continue to refine those bins and to expand them and to give them additional detail.
So for those of us who don't really know this so intimately, Dr. Garber, let's say now you go in and you manage to narrow down what kind of breast cancer a woman has. And maybe with this map, you can even stare directly at a depiction of what's happened here, what's mutated. Do we have medicine that can change the gene? You can flip the switch, the mutation, back the other way? Is that how you work with it, or are you always dealing with symptoms? How close to the very sort of code gone wrong do you get with therapies today?
Well, I think that the goal of the targeted therapies is not to flip the switch back, that would be nice, but to eliminate those cells that depend on that dysfunctional switch. So if you've knocked out a control somehow, the mm-hmm. cell is in the on position when it shouldn't be, or the off,
replicating,
you try to get rid of those cells.
You try to get rid of the cells. Dr. Perreault, is this the path toward a cure, somehow flipping the mutation back the other way? Is that possible at all today?
We're certainly striving to do it. Many of the newest targeted therapeutics are attacking specific proteins, and in a few cases, they even attack just the mutated version of these proteins. And so that is the hope, and these drugs are being developed, and many are in early phase clinical trials. So as we make the genetic discoveries and develop the new genetic tests, these are going to go hand in hand with this large number of new targeted agents that are being developed. And if we can match the right drug with the right genetic lesion in an individual patient, then we will make more advancements in helping patients.
Dr. Garber, I'm sorry to grapple around with metaphors here, but we just don't, a lot of us have the technical understanding. I think when you talk about a full genetic map, it can sound to a layman like a kind of giant instrument panel or switchboard with switches all over it. So let's just go in and, you know, if there's a switch flipped the wrong way, let's flip it back. And does genetics work that way? Can we go in, and if there's a mutation, do we have even a conceptual notion of how to go in and reverse the mutation? Or again, I guess, is it always fighting the fire that mutation has started?
Well, I think we'll let Chuck comment on this too.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem in cancer cells is that it's the exceptional cell where it's a single gene that's responsible for the problem. Mm-hmm. Many cells have multiple mutations. And part of the goal is figuring out which of the mutations are driving the cell, which are the ones that really need to be eliminated or switched back or knocked out, and which other ones seem to be more along for the ride. Also, unfortunately, and this is a recent challenge, that many tumors have more than one population of cells, and at least you'd like to figure out which is the dominant one causing the most trouble and target that at least first. The goal is to target all of it and eliminate these cells, as you mm-hmm. suggested. That's a cure.
Is that conceptually within reach, Dr. Peru, that we could, medicine could go all the way upstream to the, I guess, sometimes knot or complex of mutations here and turn them around? Or is that still beyond us even conceptually?
No, it's definitely conceptually within reach, and you know, we're doing experiments in the lab to try and achieve that goal even as we speak.
Wow, we've got lots of callers and lots of questions here, and I want to be sure to get to them. Columbia, South Carolina, Catherine is calling. Catherine, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I am a breast cancer survivor, 2 years out, and I had 95% estrogen positive, 5% progesterone positive in the right at stage zero,
mm-hmm.
and I've had a bilateral mastectomy, and on the left, they incidentally found a lobular carcinoma of a pretty significant size, but they told me that was more of a precancer, and I wondered if that was a very strange presentation and if that is something that had any findings in their research. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Catherine, thank you. This sounds like a different kind of cancer in each breast, Dr. Garber, if I understand what Catherine's saying.
I believe so, although it sounds like perhaps the second side was more of a precancer
yes.
than a cancer. But this was a case where at least there's some characterization that these were hormone-driven and perhaps in Dr. Peru's luminal A group. And I would say this is the most common subtype of breast cancer currently in the U.S., and we do cure many women who find their cancers early and have them taken care of with not only surgery and radiation mm-hmm. still, but also hormonal treatments.
Would it be the same treatment in this case for each breast, Dr. Peru, or do you have circumstances in which you're having different treatments within one woman's body for different presentations of cancer?
Well, I'll have to defer to Judy for that one. I'm not a medical oncologist, but roughly speaking, it sounded like her two tumors were similar, and of this possible luminal A estrogen receptor positive subtype, and that would dictate to get a common treatment.
Judy?
So people can have rarely two cancers at the same time, and most often they are similar. Every so often they are not. But I think, you know, the hope is to characterize them specifically so that you treat both of them correctly.
And how much more specific in understanding and treatment are we likely to get? I mean, do you look at what Chuck has laid out here along with his team and say, well, we need 17 or 42 new medicines here to get much more tailored to very specific presentations? Is that going on?
Well, I think what we have gets us part of the way. And now the question is to get the rest of the way, are we going to need lots of very specific targeted therapies? You know, we have made a huge difference, for example, with the drugs that target HER2.
Mm-hmm.
They have saved the lives of many women. That's already well documented. So this idea of knowing a genetic abnormality and using a precise agent, that's That's fact. That's not even just hope anymore.
Of course.
The question is, how much better can we get?
Well, of course. And a lot of women who deal with this, no doubt, they're sitting around thinking, well, it's so much more targeted today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. But that may leave them thinking, gee, maybe it could be even, 100 times more targeted. How soon can we get there? I mean, is this research going on now? Are we adding new, more targeted drugs, I don't know, every year, every 6 months, every... Is that kind of increasing specificity of treatment happening continually, Judy, or is it a breakthrough every time we find a new niche to address?
So I think we also want to hear what Chuck thinks about this, but I think that is the direction of the pharmaceutical industry and the direction of scientific research. We've had many years of treating patients with drugs that were not targeted, that had tremendous side effects because they affected the normal cells as well as the cancer cells. The idea of using treatments that are more precise, that can target only the abnormal cells and have fewer side effects, we're in that era. We've made that progress, not only in breast cancer, but in melanoma finally, mm-hmm. in to some extent in lung cancer, to rare cancers, to leukemias. This is the future. I guess my only hesitation would be saying mm-hmm. that it's not only genetics that will get us there. There's more. But this is the way I think we want to go, and this helps us. It really takes a giant step toward that for breast cancer.
Dr. Peru, do you look at current treatment as showing, are we going to look back on it one day and look at it as crude in spite of the tremendous increase in sophistication? Where are we on this sort of arc toward, perfection here?
I hope we look back and say it's crude. I believe that over the next few years, each year a new drug or two will get approved, and we'll get more and more personalized medicines. There'll be more and more drugs in the arsenal, and 5 to 10 years from now, it may be quite sophisticated with, 10 or more drugs will be used, and a subset will be used for each patient, and so the oncologist's job is going to get harder. They're going to have to know more mm-hmm. drugs and how to when to give them. But that will happen, and it should make improvements for outcomes.
Judy, do you think we have the diagnostic horsepower to keep up with these findings? I mean, over here is medical understanding, research understanding. Over here are lots of women, and you've got to figure out exactly what's going on with them with ever greater subtlety, I guess, and nuance here if you're going to be more and more targeted. Is that widely dispersed diagnostic horsepower in this country?
I don't think it is yet, but that's coming. And I would say, and I'm sure Chuck would agree, that not only do you need to be clearer about the diagnostics, but you do have to do the research to prove that the therapeutics are targeting what you think they're targeting, mm-hmm. that the effects are correct, that the drugs are tolerable, mm-hmm. that they actually make things better instead of only hypothetically. And that's not to be skeptical. I think we're all tremendously hopeful. But it isn't just that we can go from this finding and this window to treatment by next week mm-hmm. or next year. And I would say, we have made progress. People do survive, just not
Absolutely.
Everybody. And it's everybody that we have to want to get. And unfortunately, or fortunately, it's work and it's funding. Without research funding, we will see the promised land and not get there.
Well, is there a problem with funding at this point?
I think
a particular problem?
In this economy, as mm-hmm. everything is under review, and funding has declined functionally for cancer research.
Federal funding or private contributions or all of the above?
Federal funding tremendously, and private contributions try to fill the gap. I think federal funding for research, in Massachusetts, we benefit tremendously from this economically because there's work and there's whole industry that comes mm-hmm. from it and from its products. But we will not be able to leap forward in the way that we can see we must and can without at least consistent research funding, and that is in jeopardy.
Let's get a call from Franklin, Tennessee. Kay is calling. Hi, Kay. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. Very fast medical history. My daughter had grade 0 ovarian cancer, had her ovary removed, was told she would be fine, and it's no fault of the doctor, that's not what I'm saying, but mm-hmm. she 2 years later was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer and mm-hmm. consequently died. She was 32.
Sorry.
My mother also, who was 84 had triple negative breast cancer and died, as did my first cousin. Now, what we have been told, we had genetic testing done, and we were told that there could not find a genetic link to this. Yeah, does your work impact that? Is there any light that you can shed on this particular situation? It looks like a genetic link, but we haven't found it.
Okay, let us pick that up. Dr. Peru, what about it? You've mapped the whole thing. Does it help us understand any better the kind of trail of inheritance that families may be facing?
I mean, based on that rough family history, it sounds like there may be a family history, but they performed the two standard genetic tests for deleterious variants in BRCA1 and 2, I'm guessing, and didn't see that. So we're all left where we are right now. We just don't know if there's a genetic component to this. In the future, and hopefully not the too distant future, using these new technologies that we used in this paper, we may just be able to sequence these individuals' entire genomes, and instead of looking at just two genes, we can look at all 20,000 and see if we can find an explanation for if there's a genetic component to what this family has experienced, but we can't say so right now.
Dr. Garber, what about Kay's story and others listening? Whenever this touches anybody, of course, they think about, what about my mother, my daughter, my cousin, my family? Do you expect much more fine-grained understanding of these genetic linkages between family members to come out of this?
I think we do. Even in Chuck's paper there, they did confirm that about 10% of the cancers that they evaluated occurred in people who had a genetic predisposition, not all related to BRCA1 and BRCA2, but that there are other genes. And I think the genetics community is just beginning to explore these other genes. So I think there's hope, Kay, that we'll figure that out in the next years, either with the genes we know about or, as Chuck says, with technologies that let you look all across the genome. So we're not very far away from that at all. That's in some ways a simpler problem than the problem of the cancer once it arises.
So simpler because you can see predisposition or will be able to see it.
Well, I shouldn't overstep because it isn't simple. And the problem is, of course, then knowing how to prevent the cancers once you know the risk is present. But I do think that genetics has advanced and will continue to advance to allow us to explain more families like Kay's, which today we can't explain with the genes that we know about best.
Prevention through lifestyle choices or actually some kind of pharmaceutical intervention to prevent?
I think we'd all hope for a combination of things. We would, of course, we all say we would rather not have to take medication to prevent disease. We do that for heart disease. We take cholesterol-lowering drugs,
statins,
and antihypertensives and prevent heart attacks and strokes. In breast cancer, we've had some drugs that work, but they have side effects people don't like. But I think for people who have significant risk, families like Kay's, which are not as rare as we'd like, there are some lifestyle issues for everybody, low-fat diets or less calories, more exercise, more vegetables. And then there will be medication. There, unfortunately, still surgery when the risk is high enough.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the first comprehensive genetic analysis of breast cancer, our new understanding of breast cancer and treatment as it is emerging. Just Sunday in the journal Nature, a big study out. First time the whole thing is laid out right there. The lead author of that study is with us, Dr. Charles Peru from the University of North Carolina, joins us from Chapel Hill. With me in the studio, Dr. Judy Garber from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and it's great to have both of them with us. And Chuck, Judy, it's interesting. I mean, people really want this to work and to succeed, but after all these years, there's a lot of skepticism out there as well, and you can see it in our, responses on air here. Yar says the televangelist media arm of cancer research tells us every week that a new cure is just around the corner. Send money today. Kind of, feeling fed up with that. Here's another listener says, when you actually start curing cancer, let me know. I'll be excited and relieved. Until that time, it's all unhatched chickens and pie in the sky. Here's another who says, had a stepmother die in part from breast cancer, but one thing to say right away is that this has every chance of leading to the next crazy expensive treatment heaped on families with a critically ill family member. There is a lot of sensitivity about the same industry that's trying to come up with treatments elicits a lot of skepticism and pushback because we've been in this kind of middle ground and it is expensive for a long time. Do you find that in patients who come in, Judy? I mean, they want treatment. Everybody wants salvation, but also skepticism about the biz?
I think you can't blame them. And I don't think the scientific community is completely absolved, but we can't take responsibility alone. You know, there. And so you'll forgive me, Tom, but I think the media, you know, anything with breast cancer is news. And it must be a constant setup for things that are supposed to be the next great thing and are not. I don't think that that's true in this case, but I can certainly understand patients who feel that and the public who feels they've had lots of promise. Where's the delivery? But I would say at the same time, cancer turns out to be a much more complicated problem than people had originally thought. 200 diseases, probably not one. Mm-hmm. And I think over the years, science has made tremendous progress, but has not yet been able to deliver in the way anyone would like the cures that we all are waiting for. I don't think it's time to give up, though. Mm-hmm. I think there's been so much progress that now you really are closer. Cost is a huge issue, an enormous issue in every way, and we as a society have to take that on. But if we can actually deliver those cures, maybe we can find a way to afford it, too.
Nancy in Hartford, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's such a pleasure to be on your show. I'm a 54-year-old woman. I don't have breast cancer, but I learned early on in my nursing career that we all carry cancer cells, but what we consume are carcinogens, which develop those cancer cells. And I think that a lot of our foods that we eat and the things that we are surrounded by, plastics and all these things, are carcinogens that feed these cancer cells. And why can't we go to the source of, you know, let's eliminate that. Let's go back to glass. Let's go back to paper bags. Let's go back to the natural way. And also, I've been on supplements since I was 19 years old. I don't look 54. Most of my friends think I'm 39. I take good care of myself. I exercise. I eat. I spend more money on food than I do rent.
So watch out for carcinogens and live right. We're all for that. I mean, Dr. Prue, how about it? Here's another listener online says there's so much research on cancer treatment and so little on what might be causing it. Cancer treatment makes money for drug companies, but cancer prevention threatens chemical companies. Maybe that explains the silence on prevention. Here you are laying out the genetics. But, of course, those mutations, as we noted earlier, they presumably happen for reasons. And our listeners are very tuned in to, you can hear it in our call right here from Nancy, on the potential environmental reasons for that. Do we have the right balance, Chuck, of research on treatment versus research on why is this happening in the first place?
So I'll have Judy can do some comment on this as well. But we, you know, there is research on prevention, but it's actually in many ways much harder than the therapeutics, because in the case of the prevention studies, you actually have to possibly give medications to women who are normal. And so any side effects are really almost unacceptable in these very large prevention studies, which take decades to complete and tens of thousands of patients to adequately run.
But I think so, Nancy and our listeners are not asking about preventative drugs. They're asking about the environment in which we live and whether it is culpable in causing cancer, breast cancer included, and whether, you know, the sort of balance of effort that is focused on cleaning that up, maybe the cause in the first place of those mutations you're finding, Doctor.
So there are also studies sponsored by institutes of the NIH, like the Environmental Health Sciences Institute here in North Carolina, focused on trying to quantify and identify the possible chemical causes of breast cancer and other cancers. And so this research is being performed, I don't know if Judy knows any of those results.
Well, I think I would have to say that epidemiologists have been focused on the causes of cancer for decades, and they've made progress, and they have been funded. It's not for lack of trying that we don't know what causes breast cancer. For cancers we do know, like lung cancer, you know, getting people to stop smoking, and now the huge focus on obesity, trying to change our diet, our lifestyle within this environment, which has changed, is a huge effort and an incredibly important national health priority. But if you look around the world, even in cultures where there is no specific chemical exposure like we live with, there's still cancer. So
1.3 million global cases per year, nearly half a million deaths per year.
Absolutely.
Globally.
We have to think about this in a global way now.
Dolores in Belmont, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Dolores. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a 68-year-old woman who had a diagnosis of breast cancer 3 years ago, BRCA1 and 2 negative, estrogen receptor positive. There was no palpable or visible mass on my routine yearly mammogram, God bless him, the radiologist said, architectural distortion, recommend biopsy.
Okay.
And that's how the diagnosis was made.
Mm-hmm.
I then was treated with radiation and oral medication. My sentinel node was negative, though most of it was lost in a machine used to process the tissue.
Okay.
Very unfortunate.
Hmm.
My question is, what do the findings of the people on your program suggest regarding review of slides and evaluating need for any further treatment rather than waiting for a recurrence?
That's a very good question, given what we've now learned, what we see in Dr. Peru's study. Does somebody like Dolores need to go back and have that reviewed? Is there new insight that may apply to what's known about her own situation?
I'll take the first stab. Maybe Chuck would like to add. I would hope, Dolores, that wouldn't be necessary for you. It sounds like this was small and it was characterized using the current markers like estrogen receptor and may have even had some more molecular tests done that are available now and have been validated and shown to really predict how treatment will work. Hopefully, there's enough from what you've had that the treatment you're already getting can be shown to be the right one. I think it's going to take some time to go from where Chuck's findings would take us. I'm afraid that, like most cancer research, the beginnings will be in people whose tumor has come back, trying to see if you can show why it did and what treatment did and didn't work, and then going back to healthy people with a new cancer diagnosis moving forward. But surely the day will come, I hope, when this kind of information will make sure that we are even smarter about giving you exactly the right treatment. I hope you've had it now.
Dr. Peru, what do you say? Is there insight in your big findings here that would or should lead some women to go back for a more sophisticated diagnosis of what they're dealing with?
Well, now you're beginning to talk about the translation of this research from the research setting into the clinic. And that's going to take a few years, and so the immediate answer is these women may not need to go out and get all their genes sequenced today, but in the future that will likely be a test. So, you know, we're now in this translation phase, and so the findings from this paper can be tested in some existing clinical trials to see if it provides new information about who may respond to the drug being tested in the trial or not. and also, it has sparked some new ideas for new clinical trials. So now it's just going to, you know, these new trials will be run, and then it'll take a few years to see if some of these discoveries actually are what we call biomarkers of responsiveness. So we have to be cautious in this approach because amongst the hundreds or thousands of variants we've found in this study, some of them are likely to be biomarkers of responsiveness and most are not. And so we have to rigorously test to see which is which.
Judy, our time is short, but re-look?
Well, I would hope that for women who have, like, this caller, a small tumor found on a mammogram that's hormone receptor positive with the nodes that are negative, her chance of doing extremely well with current therapies are extremely high, more than 90%, even without this new technology.
Well, women are listening closely, and of course, men affected as well, and you can hear it in our questions and comments today. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Judy Garber, Director of the Center for Cancer Genetics and Prevention at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Thank you very much for being with us, Judy.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Charles Peru in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, at the Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of North Carolina, lead author on the big new genetic analysis of breast cancer. Dr. Peru, thank you so much to you.
My pleasure.
In a moment, men, longevity, and testosterone. This is On Point. Scientists looking at data on eunuchs in Korea from the late 1300s to the early 1900s have discovered that they died on average around age 70, compared to the early to mid-50s for their peers. Joining me now to talk about these findings is Florian Mottersbacher. He is senior editor at Current Biology, which published the study. Florian, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be here.
So anybody who's heard of this, first of all, is kind of struck by even the possibility that you could do a study ranging over nearly 600 years and that eunuchs would be at the heart of it. What was the circumstance in Korea that led there to be this record of a significant eunuch population over such a long time?
Well, I think this I have to slightly correct you, unfortunately. I
yes,
mean,
please.
The actual record, the actual period of the eunuchs is a little bit shorter than the 600 years you mentioned. But they are very fortunate because a eunuch in the early, in the late 18th, early 19th century started to keep a record, the so-called Yangtze Kebo, which is a genealogical record of the eunuch families. And they also recorded birth, death, and entry into the court. And from that, the researchers could extract the lifespan data.
I see. So this the role of the eunuch in Korean society, I guess, is what I'm looking at here from the 1300s to the 1900s, the
yeah.
Joseon Empire period.
Yeah.
They played a special role, especially in the royal court.
That's right. I mean, that's a common phenomenon you find, you know, in a whole range of societies ranging from ancient Egypt to the Ottoman Empire, to China, you know, some very notable Chinese, even Sheng He, the big general, was a eunuch. So that's a very general pattern. But what is really interesting about these eunuchs in Korea was that they kept such a close family record, and from that they could extract this data. And the pattern is really striking. I think these 15 years difference over a lifespan of, you know, 70 years, that's a huge difference. And what is even more striking, if I can briefly mention that, is that 3 out of the 81 eunuchs they investigated lived up to 100 years.
And
so
the
three in 80, which is like 1 in 27. And normally in the U.S. now, you have about 1 in 4,000 who live over 100.
So I guess the clear presumption here, I mean, the missing element in a eunuch will be testosterone. These are men who are not going to have those hormones. In this noble class of eunuchs in Korea, they were either castrated in order to join that class, or in some cases by accident, castrated or lost that, and so ended up here. What's the connection between testosterone or its absence and longevity, Florian?
Well, the honest answer is we don't know yet. And the problem is there, of course, in humans, just like this study, you know, everything is a correlation because we cannot manipulate testosterone levels. And that's why this study is so interesting, because this is really, you know, if you were doing an experiment with mice or rats, that's exactly the experiment you would want to do. You would want to remove the testosterone altogether and see what happens.
But I'm reading here, Kyun Jin Min, the South Korean is Inha University, saying testosterone is known to increase the incidence of coronary heart disease.
That's true.
And reduce immune function in males.
That's true. These two things are very well established, especially the immune function, that testosterone suppresses the immune system is a well-known fact, and that's well established in a number of animals across mammals, basically.
Is this related to the different longevity in human males and females?
Women
tend to live longer.
That's one of the assumptions. I mean, overall, if you think about an animal has a limited set of resources, or a human for that matter, and these resources need to be allocated to different processes in the body. One very important process, obviously, is reproduction. So you can see that if the testosterone level is high, more resources will be allocated into reproduction, whereas other processes, such as, you know, protecting your body from pathogens, that's then, you know, slightly turned down and suppressed.
So is this suggesting a formula like more testosterone, more reproduction, fewer years on Earth?
Well, you know, it's never easy to make such sweeping statements, because obviously testosterone as a hormone, it floats around the body. It affects all sorts of things in your body, and I think the challenge now for researchers in this field is to really disentangle where the testosterone acts and where the effects on lifespan come from. I mean, this is still a very, you know, young field, but it's a suggestion.
What about all those guys out there taking testosterone supplements of one kind or another? And when they hear this ancient history of Korean eunuchs, are they going to throw those tubes
That's
out the
right.
window?
I mean, the thing there that you also have to bear in mind is, of course, that the time... The effects of testosterone over lifespan may vary greatly. So right now it's really popular to take testosterone fairly late in life, so at your, you know, in your early 50s, to get a second boost of energy, so to say. So it also depends on your stage in life where you take it.
Florian Mottersbacher, senior editor at Current Biology, publishing this study. Kings and royal family members dying in their 40s and 50s in Korea, then eunuchs living on average till 70. We will think carefully about this one. Florian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks for being here. This is On Point.